last class in this series on Asanga's treatise on the Bodhisattva precepts. We're on page 5, near the bottom. This last section here, we started last week, backing up a little. Even in the case of what is reprehensible by nature, you see that part?
Yep.
The Bodhisattva acts with such skill and means that no fault ensues. Rather, there's a spread of much merit. So this is coming at the end of this, near the end of this long text. It talks about all the great, wonderful, compassionate practices that the Bodhisattvas do. And here it's maybe assuming that we're kind of steeped in these obvious, difficult, beneficent practices. Now there's some surprising practices that might not look so beneficent on the surface. So I think this is a sort of dangerous section here, I think. Right? There's a lot of room for self-deceit. But it really brings out the radical nature of the Bodhisattva way, that no matter what they do, they're acting for the benefit of all beings. So even if it looks like it goes against what's here called reprehensible by nature, or, you know, these natural precepts. So there's pratimoksha precepts that might not be necessarily natural or universal. They might be more like cultural, like precepts like the monks not eating after noon is not like a natural precept. There's nothing wrong with eating after noon, right? But it's a training for monks. It's as a specific practice for certain people. But the natural precepts like not killing, stealing, misusing sexuality, those are like, I think every culture in the world. They might disagree on the details of what they mean, but there's some universal agreement that those are like, they're based on the belief in separation from others. I think that's why we could say they're natural. You know, to kill living beings is like based on the view that like, not only are they separate from us, but like, they should be abolished. they don't deserve to live. And because they're some kind of affront to me, so therefore I will extinguish them. I think all cultures have some version of this natural. So here, Asanga is going to take we could say 10 natural precepts, which are very similar to our 10 Bodhisattva precepts in Zen. Really, they're called like the 10 wholesome actions that are even in the Pali Canon. There's, you know, three body precepts, 4 speech precepts, and 3 mind precepts. In a way, maybe we shouldn't call them precepts, because they're never really called that. They're more like wholesome actions. But the body is not killing, not taking what's not given, not misusing sexuality. The speech ones are not speaking falsely, not speaking of others' faults. We have those as our precepts. All these so far we have as precepts, right? But then the other two speech ones, not no harsh speech, like kind of just...
Is that like slander?
I think it's more just like angry, harsh, insult, direct insult, abusive speech, abusive or harsh. So that's not strictly speaking one of our precepts. Well, of course, the spirit of it is. And then no idle chatter is the 4th of the speech ones. And we don't even, that's maybe the hardest, right? Almost anything we say could be seen as some sort of distracting, sometimes it's like meaningless talk. in a way, it's maybe the least harmful. It's not directly so harmful. It's just like, it's just not benefiting. It's not benefiting or harming, maybe. It's just like wasting time. And I confess, and I think we all probably can, that we engage in a lot of this. If this was a precept, we'd be in trouble. But anyway, it's right. Yeah, I think, and why it's not so directly harmful to others. But when we look at, when Buddha talked about these four types of wrong speech, he was trying to be all-inclusive, I think. So here, this is one of them. And then the three mind ones are similar to our precepts of, you know, greed, hate, and delusion, basically. Like we have no possessiveness and no indulging in anger and not slandering the three treasures. It's a little different than delusion, but it's related. So of these 10 wholesome actions, Asanga is going to take the first 7, which are all the body and speech ones, and say like, there, and give examples of times that we would break all of them one by one in order to benefit beings. So, and he doesn't use the last three because the mind ones, because a bodhisattva would never like distort their mind to benefit beings. There would never be a reason to do that. It's just because their mind would always be coming from a place of compassion. But with body and speech, skillful means could be used to benefit people. Like, for example, I'm not going to internally just generate a thought of anger or greed, like that would be beneficial. I might act in such a way that looks greedy or angry, but to make my mind that way would never be beneficial. That's the logic. Does it make sense? So last week, we talked about the not killing one, which I think sometimes gets brought up of, like, there's a ship captain who's, you know, about to kill everybody on the ship, and in this hypothetical situation, there's no way to just stop him or lock him up, which would be better. There's no other way, supposedly, than to kill him. To prevent him from killing all these others. So the bodhisattva, you know, with a mind of great compassion, kills this person. And it's interesting, in the Asanga mentions, it's partly to prevent that person from killing all the others, but maybe even more importantly, it's to prevent that person from accumulating this karma of killing all these people. It's to help them, you know, it's even like, I think he even says, like, I'm even willing to go into hell realms myself from this killing act to prevent that harmful person from going into hell realms in their next life or this life or whatever. So ideally it's to benefit many beings, and it's particularly to also benefit the one who's doing the harm. So now the next one is taking what's not given. This is where we're up to here. Accordingly, the bodhisattva, if she has the capability, acts with the thought of compassion or the intention of bringing benefit by overthrowing kings or high officials from their power, in which they spread great demerit by being violent and pitiless towards sentient beings engaged in great oppression of others. So they might even combine this with, they might assassinate them by killing, but in this case, the commentary makes it clear that this overthrowing is taking it's taking the position that's not given. It's like a coup, right? So you take over the government that's not given to you to do. And that's a taking what's not given to benefit others. And then another example in the material realm is the bodhisattva confiscates property from robbers and thieves, those who steal the property of the community and shrines for their own enjoyment, particularly those who are stealing from, you know, temples or Zen centers or something. And she thinks, let not this enjoyment of property result in extended harm and misfortune for them. So similarly, it's like, you can imagine maybe somebody's already stolen something from the temple and they're like, I don't know, expensive Buddha statue or something, and they're going to go sell it and keep the profit. So the bodhisattva sneaks in. It sounds like they could maybe even stealthily steal it back. And then, you know, I don't know if that undoes the karma from the person who stole it in the first place, but maybe it makes them question it. Or maybe in a way it does undo it, because it's kind of like, well, now we, you know, they tried to steal it, but they were unsuccessful. That was like pretty bad, but it's not as bad as being successful. You know, they weren't successful because I took it back, we might say. So again, it's to help the thieves from accruing this negative karma that's going to bring them unhappiness and pain. And it's to benefit the temple that makes better use of the Buddha statue for the people who come there. Upon that condition only, so this is saying, I guess that means this thought of let this be beneficial to the thief. Sounds like what the condition is. She steals it back and returns it to the community or the shrines. The bodhisattva investigates storekeepers or park custodians who carelessly waste the property of the community or shrines and those who use it for themselves. She thinks, let not that deed and that misuse result in extended harm and misfortune for them, and removes them from power. In this way, the bodhisattva, while taking what's not given, incurs no fault, but there is a spread of much merit.
What's a good definition of merit again?
Well, we were talking about like it's the result of beneficial actions, result of wholesome activity, that's practicing good and refraining from harm creates anything that's good in the sense of wholesome and with the mind of benefiting. The result of that is the merit. And then, you know, what is the result of that? One result is happiness and well-being for ourselves. When we practice good, the result of the good is we feel buoyant and more at ease. And that would be one way. Maybe I don't know if I've seen this in a traditional text, but I think it makes merit a very accessible concept, and less magic involved. If we just, it's this kind of well-being result that actually is quite tangible, and we need to accumulate a lot of merit, this teaching, to realize awakening. So it makes sense that we need to accumulate a lot of really deep well-being in order to keep generating more for others. And to settle deeply into meditation. And also, we can take this well-being. This is the part that's a little bit more like hard to understand from a maybe scientific point of view. But we can transfer, we can dedicate the well-being. If the merit's well-being, right? We can, and again, it's an intention. We just did this chanting. And we hopefully do really wholehearted chanting, just give ourselves to it, and then we feel good, especially if we're all on pitch. and then we like, oh wow, and it's kind of like a group. I feel good, and like we feel this bond of like of energy we've created, and then we dedicate the merit of this chanting to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and the suffering beings that could use it. So the intention to share our well-being with others, you could say, is a a kind of down-to-earth way of talking about dedication of merit. I was thinking about, you know, in India, where, you know, I just was, where there's all these shrines, and sometimes it's kind of sketchy, you know, and it's small, like in Bodh Gaya, some like across the river, there's some of these small shrines, like the one I'm thinking of is a little shrine where somebody just before Buddha went to go sit under the Bodhi tree, somebody offered him this kusha grass. There's another shrine for Sujata who offered the rice pudding, but there's a nearby there, after the Buddha ate the rice pudding and could walk around kind of energetically, he's like, now I'm going to go sit down, and somebody was gathering this kusha grass and said, wouldn't you like a soft seat to sit on? Take this grass for a zafu. And there's a little diorama of the person offering the kusha grass. And it's a little tiny, tiny temple, like the size of like the little cabin back here, or smaller. And there's just a couple of Indian people there, and they got, you know, when our little group of Americans are approaching from afar, you know, not many people even end up there all day, probably, because it's kind of remote. And they see us come in, and they leap up, and please, please, come. And they're just like, there's the donation box, support the temple. We're like, first we just like to offer some incense, silently, please. We'd like to do some chanting. They were sort of, you know, we're bombarded. And there's, you know, I couldn't help feeling like, if these guys are really just the temple custodians, they shouldn't be that excited about people making a donation. I mean, I couldn't help. I don't know, but the feeling is like, maybe that money's not really going to go to restoring this totally run down little shed of a temple. But, you know, there's something not totally... Like, maybe some people are going to use these donations. They're going to take donations given to the Triple Treasure for their own use in a way that maybe isn't, like, in accord with whoever built this temple. I don't know for sure, but I hesitated to make an offering at that kind of place. You know, a monetary offering. Partly for this kind of reason, like, well, this might not be so helpful to these people if they're going to just take this for themselves, thinking they're like these suckers, Americans, giving something to the kusha grass temple. But really, no, we're just going to go take it. So, I don't know. Maybe in those cases, since we don't know, it's better to just give. But... It's this kind of, you know, this kind of going against what might be a usual giving practice, because it might actually harm the person who's like so excitedly collecting these funds. So now the third precept, misusing sexuality, maybe the most dangerous, and maybe the most unlikely to imagine this scenario, but I think Asanga, he's just going through all seven, so he's got to come up with some example for this, right? So here it is. When the Bodhisattva, desiring to comply with the expectations of any sentient being, or according with sentient beings we talked about earlier, sees that doing something involving... Oh no. Nix that. Accordingly, the lay bodhisattva comes to a woman or man with the dharma of sexual embrace, she being single and her thought overwhelmed by the agony of desire to end her celibacy. Or, you know, it's not so clear whether she has a vow of celibacy or just her lack of sexual contact, maybe. And he thinks, let her not develop a thought of hostility and much demerit spread. In other words, she's going crazy from lack of sex. I think I've even heard one version of it is like, it comes from some sutra. I think she says like, I'm on the verge of suicide. I'm actually going to kill myself if I don't have sex, like very quickly. and the bodhisattva says, rather let her come under my influence for abandonment of the unwholesome, and whatever is desired be employed as a root of goodness. Adopting a thought that's nothing but compassionate, he resorts to the non-celibate dharma of sexual conduct, and there is no fault but a spread of much merit. However, for the monastic bodhisattva, who guards against breaking the shravaka's training and vows, to resort to non-celibacy is entirely out of the question. So, lay bodhisattva. But I do find it interesting here that, as we talked about these parajika, these defeats for the monastic, these four monastic defeats for the bhikshus in many traditions, which Japanese Zen and all Japanese Buddhism, as I've mentioned before, is this one country that doesn't have these pratimoksha precepts, going all the way back to the 8th century, when Saicho, the founder of the Tendai school, said, let's make all our precepts purely Mahayana. It came from a Mahayana spirit. But if someone has this vow, but the interesting thing is the other vows, the other of the three vows, are killing humans and lying. Well, maybe lying about spiritual attainments, so that maybe would be okay here. But stealing that would be like against, that would result in like arrest according to the laws of one's country. So, but killing a person, you know, so it's interesting that these didn't say for a shravaka with bhikshu vows, killing a human is entirely out of the question. Which, you know, it would be that they should give up that vow before they kill the person, I think. But here he singles out this one, and maybe that's just because people could get all excited about this one. There's not too many chances to kill people, but maybe there's a lot of chance for this one. And the monks are like, well, she's maybe not suicidal, but I think it would be, she would appreciate this. and there's no commentary on that, but actually I think there is. When Tsongkhapa makes a commentary, there's some discussion about why does he single that one out, and I think he makes a point like this, is that it's to make it more clear for the monks with vows of celibacy.
There are a lot of Nyingma commentaries, but they're usually bawdy. Have you read the biography of Drupa Khunli?
Oh, I've looked through it. Yeah. Quite bawdy, yeah.
He sort of does it deliberately.
With as many people as possible.
With as many people as possible. And I asked Guna Rinpoche once about this. And he said, when you have Drupa Khunli's heart, you can do what Drupa Khunli did.
Mm.
It's just that simple.
Mm.
But then later he gave me, and he said, if you have to tell her that she got a blessing, you're probably not ready to give her a blessing.
That's good, yeah. You don't say, this would be good for you.
Yeah.
You just say. And also I've heard that he didn't discriminate amongst the beautiful and ugly.
Old ones, married, single. He just didn't really care. And most of them got enlightened. Or went into retreat after their affair with him.
And this is ancient times, right? This is, he was a while ago.
14th century. 14th. 1400th century.
So such things happen in the old days. Yeah. In Tibet. Just to benefit beings. Next we have speaking false. Next we have the four speech precepts. Accordingly, the bodhisattva, in order to save the lives of many sentient beings, to save them from bondage, to save them from mutilation of hand, foot, nose, ear, to protect them from gouging of eyes, will speak a false word Whereas a bodhisattva will not knowingly speak a false word for the sake of her own life. So again, clarifying that it's just to benefit others. If it's like, I better protect myself, is often why we do break all the precepts, is often to protect ourselves. Now, a little, you know, we might say, if there's really, I think the example here we could think of is like, people are being arrested unjustly, right? And the police come looking for them, and they're hiding in our basement. Have you seen them? No, I haven't seen them. You know, and there are examples like this in Nazi Germany. I think there were many.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. There's a lot of people throughout Europe mm-hmm. lied to the Nazis that they were hiding Jews.
Yeah. So that's bodhisattva action, and it breaks a natural precept, but it's to benefit beings. And this thing about not to protect oneself. I think we could think of examples where, in that, like that kind of case, where, you know, maybe are you Jewish? Maybe that person is like, I think I could be more benefit in this life to other people if I say I'm not Jewish and they don't kill me.
Yes.
And to just say, no, I don't want to protect myself. You kill me now. Yeah. So there could too be skillful means, just like bodhisattvas can practice compassion towards themselves as well as others. But I think he's making the point of emphasizing always benefiting others. There is no fault in the speaking, but a spread of much merit. Next is slander or falsely speaking of others' faults, spreading, you know, I think slander is really like spreading false rumors to harm, about others to harm them, right? So sometimes we say our precept, bodhisattva precept of not slander, but strictly speaking in the Chinese, it's like not speaking of others' faults, which is a little bit harder, a little bit more complete, I think, than just not slandering would be like not speaking falsely of others' faults. But this not speaking of others' faults could include even if it's something true about someone, you still try to avoid speaking.
I have a question. I would like to know your opinion.
Yes.
The Dalai Lama, there back in the 80s, there was a huge kerfuffle that went through the Western, and the Western Vajrayana teachers went to Dharamsala and met with the Dalai Lama. And they let up, these Tibetan Lamas have done this and this and this. And he gave a very pointed discussion. He said, you have to use your intelligence. You have to evaluate. And then you have to speak out.
Yeah.
And if you find a phony, you have to shout from the rooftop. And if you're afraid, you write me a letter and I will shout for you.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that, I'm pretty sure that didn't go over too well with a lot of Tibetans. But then the question I always had was, so you see somebody, and how do you know that they're... And even if you know somebody's a phony, you know, this other person may be completely devoted to this phony.
Yeah.
And I tried to someone to say, you know... And I, in two different circumstances. One, I said, you know, that's a phony. And I was basically... I watched the Tudors where they disemboweled some traitors, Henry VIII had them, and they showed it on TV, and I thought, oh, I've been through that, metaphorically, and not, it wasn't that much of a metaphor. And then the other one, I said, you know, this teacher is not, but it was a genuine teacher, just in that situation, it was really, I thought, way off base.
Well, I would say, you know,
the student just beat me up.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And
Well, main thing about phony, yeah. I think, is like, you know, unethical, really harming others. There's one thing if somebody's dharma is a little bit off.
Yeah.
And there's room for that, I think, too. But if they're really, like, harming others and claiming that it's okay, that's, I think, where I think that's what this is, a sangha is addressing here, is, like, even though we generally don't, Bodhisattva will do that to benefit others. And, you know, this is going on in the Zen world in America just in the last year or two, actually, as part of the, you know, email conversations with lots of American Zen teachers. This discussion is going on, just very similar to what you're talking about in Tibetans, there's various harm people see going on. For decades, we've let this go out for this very reason. And it's like, now we really see that, like, I think we really have to speak out here. And there's a lot of anguish about it. And especially for the long-term students who are actually sometimes speaking out against their teachers with great agony, which in Tibetan Buddhism is even bigger issue with samaya. But Bodhisattva, you know, and that's the thing, is like, if we're not sure, I think that's a big thing, is if we're not sure, then maybe better to err on the side of not doing it, right? Or to start checking with a lot of other people, like the people who were harmed, and maybe and try to talk with the teacher themselves, even, ideally. A lot of them don't want to. Yeah, so it's tricky, but I think there is a time when it's like, I think this would be beneficial. And I see, we had a discussion in our study group, right, about Yasutani Roshi. We're reading his commentary on the Gendo Koan, and he was being really critical towards other contemporary Zen teachers in his time, to the point of, like, it was getting difficult to read. It's like, this is like... You know, this kind of a feeling here is a little bit hard to take, but maybe this is one way we may be able to hear it. Maybe not, too. It could just be an arrogant thing, but maybe, as we talked about, I think, on that day, you know, it could be that he was passionately trying to cut through what he felt like was eroding the true Dharma through false understandings. It wasn't an ethical thing in his case. It was just about subtlety of understanding Dogen, actually. And Dogen himself, as you know, can be very critical towards other teachers. And again, usually not about ethical things, but about often quite subtle understandings. So, you know, is it coming from benefit? Do we feel, I'm really clear that this understanding is going to lead people astray. And even more so that these, you know, this understanding of what's good and bad is going to really confuse people here. So the example is, accordingly, the Bodhisattva relying upon a thought of compassion towards sentient beings who've been captured by an unwholesome advisor, like maybe a Dharma teacher that has captured them through their charisma, speaks as well as he's able, as well as he can, words to divide them from the unwholesome advisor. So I thought of, like, it could be with Dharma teachers, or I thought of, what about saying, like a prostitute, like a pimp who's like collecting prostitutes, maybe young women, and saying, I'm going to totally take care of you, and you'll be totally, this is a great job for you. I imagine it's probably like this sometimes. And the young girl's like, okay, I'll do it. Bodhisattva goes and says, actually, I think this is not going to be good for you in the long run. Like, please let me try to help you find another way. And so divides them, and actually creates and says, because this person's really corrupt, your friend who's like paying you and is your source of livelihood, they're actually evil or they're corrupt in various ways. maybe would be an example. And so you actually try to turn, and you maybe even, like if slander might even be lying, right? You maybe even say, you exaggerate. You say, actually they're worse, you know, they have these qualities, but they're even worse. They're really, really bad. And just a skillful means to help, and again, help the pimp, you know, go out of business and find a better business. For his benefit, exactly, for his benefit. This one it even goes so far as to say, let not extensive harm and misfortune come to those sentient beings through contact with the harmful companion. He enjoys such speech, even delights in it, saying like, that... I think when we read Yasutani Roshi, it seems like he's maybe kind of enjoying, like, those people are nothing but, you know, dogs. And Dogen talks this way. Enjoying and delighting in such speech. We ought to be careful with these things, right? They're radical points, for sure. Very careful. In that way, although he creates discord among friends with divisive speech, speaking of others' faults, there's no fault but a spread of much merit. This is maybe all of these, this whole section here is a section where it might be especially good to check with some other people before, you know, sometimes we may be not possible. The Nazis break into the house and like, are they in your basement? You know, well, hold on, wait, let me just check with my my friend over here. No, there's nobody here. But sometimes we might be able to like, I think they're going to come. Let's decide together, would this be good? And, you know, if a lot of people are in agreement, it's not necessarily still right, but it's more chance than one self-deceptive person. Yeah. Like maybe it's like, I'm backing it up with all these logical reasons to speak out against this person, but actually in my deep unconscious, it's a kind of self-promotion thing. Which is what speak, you know, praising self and belittling others is about promoting oneself. Next is harsh speech. Accordingly, the Bodhisattva rebukes sentient beings who are taking the wrong path, doing wrong, with words harsh and severe in order to move them from an unwholesome to wholesome situation. Although there's harsh speech on the part of the Bodhisattva, there's no fault, but a spread of much merit. I think we can think of all kinds of examples of... stop right now. Stop fighting now. And all kinds of Dharma teachers who speak very intensely and admonishingly to help beings.
Maybe some of the koans or koans?
Koans maybe not so much really harsh or... I don't know, I just... Maybe not exactly harsh speech, but actually the koan that's like sitting out on the shoe rack right now and for Neti's next week's koan class, I looked at that and I thought, maybe that one is a little bit like this. Some Zen teacher goes to some hermit, and the hermit holds up a fist as like a Zen, you know, he's testing the hermit's understanding, he holds up a fist as his direct expression of his understanding, and the teacher says something like, oh, the water is too shallow here to you know, swim in or something. Some sort of like Zen insult. And then he goes to another hermit, holds up a fist and says something like, perfectly in accord. You know, so it's kind of like using this kind of speech, you know, this is a more complex koan, which we don't want to go into tonight. But it's an interesting one about like using, it's about using insulting speech, it looks like, and praising speech to people who are doing the same thing in order to snap them, those hermits, out of some attachment they might have, and to snap us out of our attachment. That they're like, well, they did the same answer. Why do they have different responses? Why is one so critical and one so praising? And there's actually quite a few koans that are this like, you know, praise and blame thing going on. Like two monks roll up a window blind from both sides together, and the teacher says, one gain, one loss. So it's like almost like in this very direct Zen kind of way, pointing to this aspect of our mind that's really involved in gain and loss and praise and blame, and just like playing with it to free us of it. So it's not exactly harsh speech, but it's getting close.
But that's knowing exactly where each student is.
Exactly.
And then
yeah.
That yep. knowledge and appropriate response, which yep. is different for each student.
Yeah, exactly.
The same situation. And that fits.
Skillful means is all about the unique particularities of yes. this situation. And then it's going to be different the next time. That's why is bodhisattva practice so challenging. There's no like formulas. You yep. always do this way. And so this whole section is showing how there's no formulas, that you can't always follow these precepts.
Okay, that's true for life.
Yeah, well, I think so. That's true. The last speech one is idle chatter. So, accordingly, the bodhisattva, for sentient beings, inclined to dance, song, and instrumental music. So I think it's including in idle chatter like all kinds of, you know, entertainments that are just kind of maybe idle entertainments, right?
Skit night.
For those inclined to tales of kings and robbers, food and drink, prostitutes and street scenes, is skilled in a variety of dance, song, music, and narrative. They actually like become skilled in street jive. And endowed with idle chatter. She bends them to submission to her will and influence.
Compassionate intention.
She pleases them.
Oh.
With varieties of
narrative.
Endowed
with idle chatter. She bends them to submission. Having drawn them in to listen to her words, she moves them from an unwholesome to wholesome situation. So although there is idle chatter on the part of the bodhisattva, there is no fault, but a spread of much merit. So I think we really can see examples like this. I think maybe quite like Skit Night, actually, is a good one. Do we see this as just a kind of like having some fun night? Maybe we do, right? But could we see it also as this is a bodhisattva's skillful means to draw people in? Because last year at Skit Night, we had this music and entertainment, like talent night. We had more people come to the Zendo than for any other event all year. More than who came to any other event. People who just that once a year, and they make a wholesome connection with a practice place. So maybe this wasn't our intention, but could be. And I think just like being with people in ordinary ways, right? I think that kind of thing is like, it's like, I'm only going to like hang out with you if we talk about Dharma. I have to watch that one.
You're good at it.
So sometimes we're just hanging out, just to make connections. I remember a conversation once at Tassajara. It was like, I think we were talking about idle chatter in a practice period, and like really being silent, except when you need to say something useful. And somebody brought up the point, well, the so-called idle chatter is kind of like, I think she said, she called it social grease. It's like when you're, you know, if you're in a community and you're hardly ever talking, and you say you're only going to talk about like Dharma or something, it's like you're maybe not going to like have build up the intimacy with this group so much. So maybe good to just have some just casual socializing. And it's like social grease. It kind of like helps people live smoothly together, even though it's not such strict practice from a certain point of view. And then, you know, Avatamsaka Sutra, all those bodhisattvas, I think of all those examples with the Sudana on this pilgrimage to all these, the last huge long chapter of the Flower Ornament Sutra. There's this pilgrimage when Sudana visits all these bodhisattvas, and a lot of them are like musicians and even prostitutes. And they have all these, they're like craftspeople and all of these like involved in all kinds of, you know, doings in the world, but they're these great bodhisattvas that like manifest in that way. And I think they even say in some of those, they say, I have this role in order to like draw people in and then convey the Dharma to them in a way that they don't even know that it's the Dharma.
Whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes, yeah. On the Bodhisattva's path, there is nothing that is categorically a fault. In what the Blessed One has declared, know that the faults of a Bodhisattva develop for the most part from hatred or aversion rather than from desire or attachment. The intention should be viewed thus. When the Bodhisattva is ruled by love and affection for sentient beings, whatever he may do is the deed of a Bodhisattva. There's nothing he can do that's not such a deed. Nor is it possible that there is any fault in doing what she should do. When the Bodhisattva bears hatred towards sentient beings, he can do no good for himself or others, and this being what is not the deeds of a Bodhisattva, thus doing what he should not becomes, by extension, a fault. And this this quote here may be coming from the sutra. It's, I don't know if it's exact quote, but very much in the spirit of this section of text here, a wonderful sutra from the Maharatnakuta collection. This is called the Definitive Vinaya, or the Upali Assembly. There's all these short sutras in this collection. We have, in English, there's a book called A Treasury of Mahayana Sutras. It has a whole bunch from this actually really important Mahayana Sutra collection, but it's not very, there's only this one English translation of a big portion of it. Upali was the disciple of the Buddha foremost in Vinaya, in the monastic precepts. So it's Upali's coming to the Buddha and asking about precepts and Vinaya, but in the Mahayana, the definitive Vinaya. Vinaya is the monastic code, right? So the world honored one, the Buddha, told Upali, "Now, Upali, you should know that the pure precepts observed by bodhisattvas and those observed by shravakas are different in both aim and in practice." Do you all know shravakas at this point? Shravakas is like the small vehicle approach, to as opposed to the bodhisattva Mahayana approach to practice. Upali, a pure precept observed by shravakas may be a great breach of discipline for bodhisattvas. A pure precept observed by bodhisattvas may be a great breach of discipline for shravakas. And I think that the section we just read is explaining that, right? For the shravaka has to keep the precepts very literally. You just always don't kill no matter what. But for this crazy ship captain, that breaks the bodhisattva precept to not kill the person. What is a pure precept for Shravakas, but a great breach of discipline for Bodhisattvas? This is one example. For example, Upali, not to engender a single thought of taking future rebirth is a pure precept for Shravakas, but a great breach of discipline for Bodhisattvas. Right? Because the Shravakas that want to become an arhat, where you end rebirth and you don't come back. The non-returning path. But the Bodhisattvas vow to keep coming back to benefit. So that's one example. It's not exactly a precept, but he's calling it a precept here. What is a pure precept for Bodhisattvas, but a great breach of discipline for Shravakas? For example, to follow the Mahayana doctrine and to tolerate rebirths without aversion for an incalculable number of kalpas is a pure precept for Bodhisattvas, but a great breach of discipline for Shravakas. For this reason, the Buddha teaches Bodhisattva precepts which need not be strictly and literally observed, but teaches Shravaka precepts which must be strictly and literally observed. He teaches Bodhisattva precepts which are at once permissive and prohibitive, but teaches Shravaka's precepts which are only prohibitive. He teaches Bodhisattva's precepts which are for the depth of the mind, but teaches Shravaka's precepts which guide them step by step. When keeping pure precepts, Bodhisattvas should comply with sentient beings, but Shravakas should not. And I think I would add a footnote and say, Shravakas should almost always comply with sentient beings. But there are, we heard in the earlier part of a sangha, part of complying with sentient beings is not doing what they want. Right? If you remember that part. Whereas maybe Shravakas would always try to just do what's on the surface, what seems most harmonious. Outwardly, maybe like that. Then, furthermore, Upali, why do Bodhisattvas keep precepts for the depth of mind while Shravakas keep precepts which guide them step by step? Even if Bodhisattvas enjoy the five sense pleasures with unrestricted freedom for kalpas as numerous as the sands of the Ganges, as long as they do not give up their bodhicitta, they are said not to break the precepts. Why? Because Bodhisattvas are skilled in protecting their bodhicitta and dwell securely in it. They're not afflicted by any passions, even in dreams. This is very, almost tantric kind of sounding, right? Further, they should gradually root out their defilements instead of exterminating them all in one lifetime. They should take their time. In contrast, Shravakas ripen their roots of virtue as hurriedly as if they were saving their heads from fire. They do not like to entertain even one thought of taking further rebirth. So this is a really nice commentary, I think, also on this whole Bodhisattva path, right? And interestingly, the main point here is that Bodhisattvas can act out of desire is not such a problem. They eventually do have to, over a long time, have to, work through all their desires, but the Shravaka is like, I got to end this right now. And I think you can see in the Shravaka approach, there's a lot of focus on one's own internal mental cultivation, and not as much emphasis on just benefiting others, no matter what. So Upali asked the Buddha, world-honored one, suppose a bodhisattva breaks a precept out of desire, another does so out of hatred, and still another does so out of ignorance. World-honored one, which of the three offenses is most serious? World-honored one, answered Upali, if while practicing the Mahayana, a bodhisattva continues to break precepts out of desire for kalpas as numerous as the sands of the Ganges, his offense is still minor. So it still is kind of an offense, especially if the desire, the precepts of desire harm others. That would be the main thing. Why? Oh, let's see. If a bodhisattva breaks precepts out of hatred, even just once, his offense is very serious. Why? Because a bodhisattva who breaks precepts out of desire still holds sentient beings in his embrace, whereas a bodhisattva who breaks precepts out of hatred or anger forsakes sentient beings altogether. I think it's a wonderful way of talking about this. It's like, I'm getting all caught up and my life's a mess because of desires, and maybe particularly talking about I'm attached to people, but it's still holding them, and it's better to be attached to people than to be angry at people in the Mahayana. And I think even we don't want to equate Hinayana with Theravada. These are two different. Theravada is an actual school, but you know, if there are some similarities, I think you can. My experience in the Theravada monastic practices, which is very emphasized in Theravada, is so much about desire and a little bit about hatred and aversion, but so much emphasis on restraining any kind of sense desire. It's just more emphasis and focus. So these are two. Out of the three, out of greed, hate, and delusion, right? Upali, a bodhisattva, should not be afraid of the passions which can help him hold sentient beings in his embrace, but he should fear the passions which cause him to forsake sentient beings. Upali, as the Buddha said, desire is hard to give up, but is a subtle fault. Hatred is easy to give up, but is a serious fault. Ignorance is the most difficult to give up, and is a very serious fault. I think it's a great little exposition of the three poisons, and desire, and it, to me it rings true actually. Desire is very hard to give up. There's, you know, all kinds of subtle, like the sensory world is just impinging on us constantly in little ways, like. So I heard one teacher mention recently, just notice that you want to stay in that warm shower just like half a minute longer. It's like a sense desire, right? I do.
I was trying to turn off the shower in order to save water.
Even that's hard.
And I said, when I went in, I said, oh, it's the middle of the day. I should be able to do this easy rather than when it's the beginning of the day when it's cold outside.
Yeah.
But I couldn't do it.
This is how it is. Very hard to give up, but it's not such a problem, actually.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. I still wondered why.
The
gas department, right? Yeah. But then anger. It says easy to give up. We might say, well, anger is not so easy to give up either, right? But in some ways, I think, you know, it comes on very quickly, so it catches us unawares. But I think if we're quite stable, desire is even more sneaky. It's just, I think it's subtler. Right? But anger, maybe that's the thing. Anger is kind of, we notice it. It's a strong feeling. So maybe that makes it easier to give up, and it's a big fault. So therefore, for the sake of efficiency, wouldn't it make sense to work on the easy ones to give up that are actually big faults first, emphasize those. But then we have, the problem is here, is we have this ignorance or delusion, and I think we're talking about the subtle delusion of believing that things exist, right? Is like very hard to give up. But very big problem, because ultimately speaking, it's the root of the other two.
Yeah.
If we really don't think that angry person over there exists separate from us, then we don't get angry back at them. Mm-hmm. So that's why the bodhisattvas have to meditate on emptiness, mm-hmm, to really not get angry.
Or expand the container to see that was my mom or my dad in a previous incarnation.
That'd be part of wisdom. Who? Yeah, so that's a nice little piece to take away, I think, from the spirit of this whole thing. I'll read again. The Buddha has said, desire is hard to give up, but is a subtle fault. Hatred, or anger, is easy to give up, but is a serious fault. Ignorance is difficult to give up and is a very serious fault. So you could say, well, if it's the most serious, shouldn't we work on that? Well, let's work on the easiest and serious one first. First, let's be compassionate and then start looking at how our mind is constructing illusion. Upali, when involved in defilements, bodhisattvas should tolerate the small transgressions which are hard to avoid, but they should not tolerate the grave transgressions which are easy to avoid, not even in a dream. For this reason, if a follower of the Mahayana breaks precepts out of desire, I say he's not a transgressor, but if he breaks precepts out of hatred, it's a grave offense, a gross fault, a serious degenerate act. This is the Buddha speaking harshly, which causes tremendous hindrances to the Buddha Dharma. So, being very strict about that in the definitive Vinaya, very different from the early Vinaya. That may be what Asanga is quoting here, that the Blessed Ones declared, know that the faults of a bodhisattva develop for the most part from hatred or aversion, rather than from desire or attachment. Yeah.
Transgressions from anger feel really bad. They go on a
natural level. Yes.
They really
yes.
Kind of get it, like, oh no.
Yep.
I was wondering.
That's why it might be easier in a way too, right?
Yeah.
Because it's more painful. Yeah. It reminds us that oh. Yes.
Kind of ricocheting with
yep.
it and
yep.
trying to sort a lot out. Wonder, but we're as interconnected when we're deluded and when we're desirous. But I wonder what's the effect of that, like
very,
wanting another cup of coffee or wanting to shower longer on others.
Very interesting.
It's yeah. there, but it's maybe
it doesn't spread like wildfire. Yeah. Yeah, great point.
The water thing spreads like wildfire.
What's that?
The water thing spreads like wildfire.
It could. Well, also, when it might spread in the sense of like, then the whole society starts feeling like, oh, it's a, like our society is a very consumptive, right? Mm-hmm. And we see, because everyone's doing it, I guess it's fine. Mm-hmm. So in that way, it spreads.
Yeah.
It's true.
I'm starving for water. We're going to run out of it. Well, people just pay penalties. If everyone just pays penalties, then there just will be not enough water.
Mm. And then that will harm beings. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And food. And
mm-hmm. And I think there's all kinds of, yeah, I think we can see that all kinds of desires are destroying the whole planet, actually, right? You could say, environmentally, it may be actually that greed and desire is causing more harm than anger and hatred. Maybe on a large scale, right?
Not to put you on the spot because I have difficulty with the shower.
I'll take that up with renewed vigor.
Everything makes a difference, but, you know, I actually did take a bucket and try to measure myself recently in the shower. Just, I'm like, how much is this using, actually? And it seemed like about a gallon a minute. So if you take a 5-minute shower and you don't catch any, which some people are trying to capture some of their water, then 5 gallons, you know, in a day or every other day or something, is probably less than we're using for, like, dishes. I mean, flushing a toilet is like a gallon and a half. So it's like 3 toilet flushes equals a 5-minute shower. So, you know, Where are we putting our... And you were thinking about all these things. In a way, they're small things, but that's the spirit, is to like pay attention to everything we're doing. Yes.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this in a historical context, the part about killing and stealing, because I'm imagining that there wasn't that much law enforcement, there wasn't a democratic society, and here were these, this society, that was, had some ethical guidelines. But it's such a slippery slope. It's different today, this consult with others because the slippery slope is that you actually think you know what's best. Really?
Yeah, like a terrorist, right? To take over the government in the name of good. And maybe a lot of people die in the process. Yeah, things are on a larger scale now. I think that there were, I think the legal system was pretty advanced. Like, I think of King Ashoka, actually, I think had really set up a lot of, government systems in ancient India. I don't know all the details, but I think there were maybe more, or maybe the same as now. I think there were ruthless leaders who killed lots of people in those days as well as now. And I don't know about how many like wild brigands. I think we have that now and then and at those times too, especially in other countries. So, but yeah, I think the principles apply throughout space and time, but the skillful means could be different in our time. Also, communication is so much easier now that we can communicate more. And before those kinds of things happen, usually a lot does build up amongst a lot of people, checking with other people and signing out the petitions and trying. I think also that maybe a little addendum here is that these are like last resort situations. That's how I would understand. You try to do all other things to benefit beings before you break the precepts. But if there's no other way, And even amongst the Vajrayana Samaya, there's one of them that's like not breaking the small vehicle Pratimoksha, the Mahayana Bodhisattva precepts, or the Vajrayana Samaya. For no reason. So sometimes you do break them, like, for reasons. And even some of the samaya maybe actually do seem to go against some of the pratimoksha. But then to say, well, then that kind of means that, like, then we should just forget about the pratimoksha. There's actually one of the actual samaya precepts is, like, don't break it just for the fun of it. Only break it if it's beneficial.
There's a movie out in the 80s called The Seventh Seal, and it starred Demi Moore, and it was about a retelling of the Book of Revelation. Mm-hmm. And they had this bodhisattva question, like the killing the ship captain.
Mm-hmm.
There's a young man, high school age or early 20s, and he's got Down syndrome, and he brutally murders someone, and it was brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember how this happens, but basically he knows that this person is going to be like the next Hitler or the next Stalin and will cause the death of 50 million people. And so he can see this, but he's going to be executed.
You mean the Down syndrome person?
The Down syndrome guy. The person that he killed was going to turn into this person.
He said that?
He says this. That's, and of course people didn't think he's crazy.
Yeah.
But they're going to execute him. And in the eyes of the world, he did a horrible thing. It was really brutal.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, no, he has to purify. And because of everything else going on in the movie, you know that, this bigger picture is happening underneath this, underneath the surface.
So in the movie, was it true? What?
I mean, yeah, in the movie, you could tell that he was like some kind of prophet.
It really was. He really was. Oh, yeah. Interesting. Wow.
It tells it, like, in such a way you think, whoa.
What's it called?
This movie is called The Seventh Seal. Uh-huh. Or The Seventh Sign. It's the seventh.
The Seventh Sign. Seventh Seal was a, wasn't that the Swedish?
Oh, yeah.
No,
yeah.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. The Seventh Sign. Yeah, and it's interesting. It's one of these interesting retellings of the apocalypse and the second coming. And that present, but in a way that you don't expect it, so you don't recognize it.
It's a great example of how complex and inconceivable everything is.
Yeah.
So that's what makes it very hard to live in this world.
I take refuge in a verse in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says to Arjuna, the laws of karma are unfathomable. Because, I mean, at last resort. That's really from...
Yep. So we just with our puny little human understanding, we just do our best. That's all we can do, right?
Well,
we try.
Being the saying, you know, the road to hell is paved by good.
Yep, that's the same one. Yep, yep, yeah.
But that's not a Buddhist saying.
It's not a Buddhist saying, but it comes up. You know, I mean, sometimes I think of it in terms of, well, if you only have good intentions but you don't act, you know, that's not okay. But I think it's also intended in that other way that, you know, you have good intentions but your actions can still...
Well, we might say, from a Buddhist point of view, might say it's about self-deception. And we say, if they're truly good intentions, that's only the road to heaven. But what the saying means is the road to hell is paved with what you think is good intentions. That's probably the actual meaning of it, right? You think it's good intention, but actually, we our capacity for self-deception is vast. So, to conclude, this great collection of Bodhisattva precepts bears the fruition of great awakening. Based on it, the Bodhisattva fulfills the perfection of ethics, Shila Paramita, and completely awakens the unsurpassed, complete, perfect awakening. And so long as he's not become a Buddha, he will, in training himself in this measureless collection of Bodhisattva precepts, obtain five kinds of advantage. She comes to the notice of the Buddhas, which maybe we could hear is like this, you know, like the sentient being meeting the Buddha is where awakening takes place. So you could say, it's like the Bodhisattva way is kind of like coming forward to meet the Buddha, where then the Buddha takes notice of us. The Buddha comes to meet us when we're practicing in accord with Bodhisattva precepts. And so that's nice to be, to come into the notice of the Buddhas. He dies in a state of great joy. After her physical dissolution, wherever she is reborn, those with the same higher precepts are found, Bodhisattva companions with the same teaching who function as spiritual advisors. So, maybe here we are due to our practice of virtue in the distant past. He's endowed with a measureless aggregate of merit that fulfills the perfection of ethics in this life. And there's a natural morality of which in future lives she inherits the very essence. All the precepts thus described, all the aspects beginning with the essence of precepts, which was this first paragraph at the beginning, should be understood to be included by the three types of precepts: the precept of standards of conduct, the precept of embracing good qualities, and the precept of benefiting sentient beings. And these three types of precepts, to put it briefly, accomplish three sorts of Bodhisattva work. The precept of standards of conduct brings about mental stability, just training the mind in pratimoksha precepts and so on. The precept of embracing good qualities brings about the maturation of the qualities of Buddhahood for oneself. So like the practice of the six paramitas, particularly the first five paramitas, are really like actually they happen to benefit others, and they're generating merit more and more that we keep giving away, and we need to keep doing this all the way to complete perfect awakening. And then the precept of benefiting sentient beings brings about the maturation of sentient beings of others. So we could say, summarized by like the four Brahma Viharas, like loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy, particularly, you could say, they also, of course, benefit or generate merit for ourselves, but they're really like benefiting others. There's a lot of overlap, of course, all three, but this is the emphasis. And therefore, they go in that order. They're taught in that order. These constitute all the work of a bodhisattva that's to be done, to stabilize the mind in order to establish well-being in the present, is the first pure precept, to ripen the factors of Buddhahood without physical or mental fatigue, is the second. And maybe you could say some of these practices sound kind of tiring, but you could say the joy that arises when we're really cooking along that path is so energizing and rejuvenating. And to bring sentient beings to full maturity. It's the third precept, to bring all beings to Buddhahood. This is Bodhisattva precepts. These are the advantages of Bodhisattva precepts. And this is the work of Bodhisattva precepts. There's nothing beyond and there's nothing more. Past Bodhisattvas desiring great awakening have trained in it. Those in the future will train in it. And those presently abiding in the boundless infinite realms of the universe are training in it.
Pretty included. This last little bit is kind of nice.
It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And kind of saying how each of the three works. Mm-hmm. So in that way, it's an entire path of practice, as was mentioned previously. You could say, well, this is just singling out one of the three trainings of Sila, Samadhi, and Prajna. Only one of the six paramitas. But in fact, the way Asanga presents it is like, it's an all-inclusive path to Buddhahood. And you could probably take any one of the paramitas and expound it in that kind of way. Any final questions or comments before we lock this text in the storehouse consciousness and go on to the next thing?
You know, I have a really bad fault, which Zongzo Kinsei recently brought out in a Facebook post. And he said Buddhists do have a Satan. It's distraction.
Ah.
And my favorite distraction is to keep up with the news. And I'm watching what seems to me a slow descent in the deliberate into fascism in this country. And I watch myself getting furious. And I think about these people who have a lot of money. Many of them, strangely enough, I met. And I think, should I sit down and meditate for them? You know, use them as objects.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, if thoughts are things, and this is what Bodhisattva practice is supposed to do, should I do that every day? And should Buddhists in every temple do that? You know, and but we actually think that because of the transference of merit in Mahayana. And then I sit there in my little apartment on Seabright and think, who am I fooling every now and then? I have, you know, the other great Satan in Vajrayana is doubts.
You mean, who are you fooling, thinking, like, how is that going to make a difference?
Right. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think, well, at least it's all I've got. I don't have a few billion to contribute,
Yeah. And in the realm of reality where the whole appearing world is generated by mind and intentions, then it's maybe not such a small thing after all. It's because the reason things are the way they are right now is because of people's intentions too. So we're going to, like, you could say, counteract that, or just maybe counteracts a little too aggressive. Maybe it's more or less, we're just send wishes for well-being, compassion, and wisdom to not just those people, but everyone. Right? And it has an effect on the world, but we may not see the effect. It has an effect on us, for sure, and then we have an effect on the world. Yeah. Very mysterious. But sounds like a wonderful practice.
I keep thinking, well, I have to try.
Yeah, can't go wrong. I think, and it's interesting what you say about, like, doubts, because you hear this whole thing about a sangha talking about bodhisattva precepts, and I can feel some doubt, like, is it really possible to practice like that? That's like, he's got such a high standard, maybe it's the age of decline and it's no longer possible. But then that's Satan.
Yeah.
that's like undermining our whole thing. So we have to just do it kind of like a fool, I think, the bodhisattva spirit. Just do it with like filling a well with snow. Just keep shoveling. People will laugh at us, but
might know.
yeah.
In the Zen tradition, you have to have great faith, followed by great doubt. What's the next one after that? Great
determination.
Determination, yeah.
Yeah, together. Yeah, not corrosive doubt that undermines our practice, but the doubt that actually fuels our practice.
Determination.
Yeah. Often, I feel like doubt actually often fuels my practice. You know, like all this Dharma study is because I have this doubting mind. It's like, wait, something's not quite worked out there. I got to go back and look further into this.
Well, I showed Pina Rinpoche in his first trip to America a movie that was on an old show about snake handlers from Tennessee, from where I'm from, just down the road. One, like the guy who was recently in the news because he got bit by a rattlesnake and he died. And they believed this verse in the Bible, and on the way, then we got in the car and we were driving to some restaurant, and I said, so what did you think of that movie? He said, it's no big deal. I said, well, do you guys do stuff like that in Tibet? And he said, those people have absolute faith. And that's why it works. Because they don't know anything. He said, they're completely ignorant. I'm sure they don't know anything about the Bible. I'm sure they don't know, it says what it says and that's good enough for them. And he said, study is so that when you're practicing, when doubts arise, you have the antidote because you've already studied it. And he said, so you either have to have a lot of education or be completely
and nothing in between.
And then silence in the garden, he said, for people like you, it's sort of too bad, isn't it?
Yeah. That's a great story. Thank you for that. Yep, it's too late.
Too bad.
For all of us, I think. Sorry. Thus, we gather up all the merit generated, the well-being and faith accumulated here through these weeks of study, and dedicated to all living beings throughout space and time. May they be touched by bodhisattva precept spirit and realize great happiness and joy. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.